Until the late 1960s, tens of thousands of American children suffered crippling birth defects if their mothers had been exposed to rubella. Popularly known as German measles, there was no vaccine and little understanding of how the disease devastated fetuses. In June 1962, a young biologist in Philadelphia using tissue extracted from an aborted fetus from Sweden produced safe, clean cells that allowed the creation of vaccines against rubella and other common childhood diseases. 2 years later, in the midst of a devastating German measles epidemic, his colleague developed the vaccine that would one day wipe out the homegrown rubella. Science reporter Meredith Wadman writes about the story in her book, The Vaccine Race: Science, Politics, and the Human Costs of Defeating Disease. The book is published by Viking, and we welcome Meredith Wadman to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be here.
What brought you to this particular story?
You know, I stumbled on it because the scientist who invented the cells that are so crucial for making today's rubella vaccine wrote a letter to the editor of a magazine in 2012 saying, you know, the Henrietta Lacks cells are getting all the attention, but I derived these cells in 1962 from the lungs of an aborted fetus, and they've been used to make vaccines that have protected hundreds of millions of people. And I thought, wow, why hasn't a book been written about this? And I phoned the scientist, whose name is Leonard Hayflick, and it kind of went from there and took up the next 4 years of my life exploring this really fascinating story.
Talk a little bit about the epidemic of rubella and how it swept the United States as the precursor to this need for the vaccine.
Sure. Well, Joe, if you or I get rubella, it's a mild disease and the same in children. It's also known as German measles. You might get a rash, you might get a fever, you might have some swollen lymph nodes, and then it goes away and that's that. But if a pregnant woman gets rubella, and particularly if she gets it in her first trimester, the consequences to the fetus are devastating. These children that were born during the epidemic of 1964 and 65 in the United States, 20,000 of them were blind, were deaf, mentally disabled. They had shrunken heads like the Zika babies you see today. They had heart defects or combinations of these conditions. Children were born blind, deaf, and with heart defects, all one infant. So it was really terrible, and pregnant women and the public at large was demanding a vaccine. So that set off a race to develop a vaccine before the next epidemic came around, because they were known to recur about every 6 or 7 years. So the clock was ticking toward 1970.
So then enter, as you mentioned, Leonard Hayflick, and give us an idea how he created these cells and why this creation was so revolutionary.
Well, at the time, the important public health vaccines of the day, particularly polio, were being developed in monkey kidney cells. Kidney cells, like other cells, are essentially used as little vaccine factories to make lots and lots of the vaccine virus, because viruses can't multiply outside of cells. So it was discovered in 1961 and became public knowledge that these monkey kidney cells could harbor monkey silent monkey viruses, and one of them, called SV40, was known to cause uniformly lethal cancers in laboratory hamsters. That had just been demonstrated, and the jury was out on whether these monkey kidney viruses, in particular SV40, was going to cause problems for the, by then, tens of millions of American children who had received the Salk polio vaccine made in monkey kidney cells. Well, Leonard Hayflick took a look at the situation and thought, why are we using these monkey kidneys that are sort of notorious reservoirs of unwanted viruses, when if we could capture clean, safe cells from just one human, we could then ascertain that that person's medical history was clean and use these cells to produce vaccines going forward. Well, where do you get clean, safe cells? You and I, we walk around, we have many, many viruses if we've been on the planet any length of time. Mm-hmm. But a fetus in the mother's womb is relatively protected from viruses. And so Hayflick set about to obtain aborted fetal tissue to capture some cells that could be used for vaccine making. And he had eventually got the cells still used today to make our rubella vaccine from the lungs of a fetus that was legally aborted in Sweden in 1962. By the way, the fetus was taken without the mother's knowledge or consent.
Enter Stanley Plotkin, who is a doctor in Philadelphia, and he comes into this story at what point?
Well, he is in London in 1962 doing his residency in pediatrics, and the big rubella epidemic that hit the United States hit London a year earlier. And so as 62 turns into 63, Plotkin begins to see these damaged babies appearing on the pediatric wards, and he is very upset by this. He sees the need for a vaccine, and in the fall of 1963, he returns to the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia after his residency, and he's determined to make a rubella vaccine as quickly as possible. He is one of the only doctors in the country who can run a test to see if a pregnant woman has in fact been infected with rubella. So he's besieged by these young couples and these young women at his office in the Wistar saying, please tell me if I've been infected. I'm 3 months pregnant. Is my fetus in danger? And the test took weeks to run, so it was agonizing for these women to wait. And when the test came back saying, you know what, you have been infected, some of the women chose to abort their fetuses. Plotkin would then ask, could I obtain your fetus because I am trying to capture a rubella virus that I can turn into a vaccine? And from one of these aborted fetuses, he captured a rubella virus, and then he used Hayflick's clean, safe fetal cells to grow that rubella virus to produce the vaccine that today protects our children and has, in fact, wiped out rubella in the Western Hemisphere.
You write about this in the book. The federal government had its reservations. What were they upset about?
You know, there was one regulator, a man named Roderick Murray, who was this very buttoned-down, quiet, sort of elitist scientist who did not make his thinking known to anyone, but it was with him that any vaccine to be introduced on the U.S. market had to pass muster. And for reasons that were known only to him and that he did not record and are now lost for good, he did not approve of Hayflick's fetal cells, and he did not want to approve any vaccine made using them. And he held out without explaining why for 10 years, even while European countries were quickly adopting these fetal cells and using them to make vaccines.
Another interesting part of the story, of course, is the trials. And I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about these first vaccine trials, how they were conducted, and really the mistreatment of the groups that came in to test them.
You know, this was something so sobering, Joe, in my research. I discovered that the use of institutionalized populations, be they prisoners, premature infants in hospital nurseries, orphans in a Catholic orphanage in Philadelphia, children in homes for the mentally disabled, all these kind of powerless people were used for vaccine and other medical trials, virtually beginning in the 1940s and right through the middle of the 1960s. And so Stanley Plotkin, like other men of his generation in medical research, when he was ready to test his rubella vaccine, turned to the nearest convenient population, in this case, 1 and 2 year old toddlers at a home called the St. Vincent's Home for Children in Southwest Philadelphia, which was owned and operated by the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. And the Archbishop at the time, Archbishop John Joseph Kroll, gave Plotkin permission to go ahead and test in this orphanage, and that's what he did.
Give us a sense of how those tests went and how it ultimately led to the vaccine that we have.
Sure. Well, it's a tricky business to develop what's called a live virus vaccine. You need to weaken the virus enough so that it does not cause disease when it's injected into people, but not so much that it also is so weak that it doesn't cause your body to generate the antibodies that will protect the vaccinee in the future. So it's a balancing act. And when Plotkin first injected the vaccine into these orphans, he had not weakened it enough, and many of them developed rubella and passed it to other infants in the orphanage. So then he went back to the lab, weakened it some more, and tested further, and finally he got it to a point where it was just the right mix of strong enough to induce a good immune response, but not so strong that it would cause rubella. That took, you know, several tries, and it needs to be said that rubella is a mild disease in children, so these children were not, you know, perishing in the halls of the orphanage. They were developing rashes and not feeling very well, perhaps, for a few days. But in our 21st century mindset, it's still a hard thing to behold.
So as you were writing this book about what happened so many years ago over the last 50 years, people are still skeptical of vaccines. And I'm interested in your thoughts scientifically of why there is this argument, and we continue to have this argument when there is. Just look at the book and what you have reported here, a great success rate with many vaccines.
Oh, it's undisputed the vaccines are the great public health success of the 20th century. And today, in the early 21st, they have become, in a sense, victims of their own success because we do not see any longer in our communities the diseases that they prevent, diseases like measles, like diphtheria, like whooping cough, that can be deadly events for small children and for infants today who are too young to be immunized. So it's really important that we recover these stories of what I call the bad old pre-vaccine days, when you would see children, you know, in wheelchairs and iron lungs with polio, or you would lose toddlers to measles when it invaded their lungs and caused a devastating pneumonia. It's easy to get complacent if we don't recall and remember these stories. I'd also like to say that while you do hear from vaccine resistors today, they are loud, but they are a minority. There was a Pew Research Center study published just last month that was surveyed adults in 2016 that found that 88% of adults surveyed among, I think it was 1,600 survey responders, believed in and were attested to the strength, the public health benefit, and the safety. In this case, it was the MMR vaccines they were being asked about. So it's really important to remember that the vast majority of American parents support this and will, I hope, continue to do so.
And, of course, we also look at science and the political pressures around science, and obviously that was an issue that we talked about in the course of our conversation, but it continues to be an issue today.
Yes, I mean, it was politicized in the 1960s, and then you come to February 2016 when President Obama asks Congress for $1.9 billion to quickly hasten the development of a Zika vaccine. And in the following 8 to 9 months, that request was stalled on Capitol Hill among political infighting related to whether Planned Parenthood should be defunded. And so there it sat, and in the process of Congress not approving these funds, in that time frame, 1,500 babies were born afflicted with Zika, with these terrible shrunken heads and other anomalies that will be problematic for them throughout their lives. Finally, in September last year, Congress freed up $1.1 billion, about two-thirds of what the president had requested, and put it towards fighting Zika, including developing a vaccine. But I think it's really important that there be a fund that is insulated from political pressure and infighting, that can be called on in situations like the Zika epidemic. And there will be more such situations, and the question is, how well will we respond to them?
The name of the book is The Vaccine Race: Science, Politics, and the Human Costs of Defeating Disease. The book is published by Viking. Meredith Waterman, I thank you very much for being with us. Great pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, The Vaccine Race. The book is published by Viking, by Meredith Waterman. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.